This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. 2 years ago, we brought you a project our reporters had been working on for years. It was one of the biggest stories we'd investigated, looking at one of the biggest public health crises at the time, the opioid epidemic. Then the world's attention shifted to a new public health crisis. The pandemic overtook all of our lives and our attention. But while we were gripped with fear and grief over a killer virus, addiction problems in this country only got worse. Over the next 3 weeks, we're revisiting our series that investigated a dark corner of the rehab industry and what's happened since our series American Rehab originally aired. We start back in 2019 with a woman named Penny Rawlings. She just had a long, sleepless night.
Well, I threw up till about 5 o'clock in the morning, cried. My husband tried to calm me down, tried to get me to go to bed. I finally fell asleep about 5:30 and I got up at 8.
Penny was not sick with a bug. She was sick because she had just read a story that made her physically ill, with a combination of fear and guilt, and she needed to contact the reporter.
I was like, I got to get a hold of this lady. I got to tell her that she's on the right track, that this isn't right. People need to know about this.
The lady Penny was trying to reach was my colleague, Reveal reporter Shoshana Walter, who we all call Sho. Eventually, Penny found Sho on Twitter, and they got on the phone.
And it was your article.
Wow.
I mean, I thought my knees were going to buckle underneath me when I started reading that.
Sho's story was about a drug rehabilitation center called Senecor, a place Penny had just sent her brother, Tim Rowe.
Could you tell me, like, what happened? Okay, so I'm 51. My brother's 46. He is skilled trades. Had a good job, owns his own home, cars, boats, motorcycle, you know.
Penny and her brother Tim live in Dayton, Ohio. They grew up right outside the city.
If you watch the news, Dayton, Ohio is pretty much the meth and heroin capital right now. It's really bad here.
Tim used to have a good job, fixing up gigantic printing presses, and he used to live with his wife and 3 kids. Then, in 2010, he had surgery on his knee and his foot. His doctor prescribed pain pills afterwards. When those ran out, he turned to heroin.
He overdosed 5 times, I found out. Two of them died. And they brought
two
him
of them, with, he died?
They brought him back with Narcan.
Narcan, the overdose reversal drug. Penny wanted to save Tim. She tried to be there for his kids and his wife. She found him an attorney. She answered his late-night calls. But she'd reached her limit.
I had pretty much cut my brother out of my life 3 years ago. And we were very close. And I told him, if you don't get clean, I will not help you anymore. I'm done. And I said, do not come to my house unless you're going to knock on the door and say, I need help.
And as Sho tells us, when Tim did come knocking, Penny was there.
Penny and Tim both agreed he should get out of Dayton and go someplace where he didn't have so many connections to drugs. That's when Penny ended up talking to Senecor about its long-term inpatient rehab program. What Senecor told her sounded really good, like in this commercial.
I was lost in my addiction.
Life was spinning out of control.
With residents strolling shady grounds and swimming laps in a sparkling blue pool.
I was gonna die. I was. Until I found Senecor. With treatments tailored to me, that truly worked.
With the counseling I needed.
Senecor understands how hard addiction is.
Senecor can help you right now. we've improved the lives of over 100,000 people with addiction issues like yours. We are affordable, we understand, and we're serious about your recovery. Let us help you get out of the pain and helplessness.
They told me that my brother would be getting 3 group sessions a week and 2 one-on-one sessions a week with a counselor. And I had to pay $3,000, well, almost $3,000 up front to send him there.
Penny handed over her credit card number. Tim got on a plane and made it to Baton Rouge, where he planned to stay for the next 8 months.
They told us that it was 8 months. He would be there 8 months, which is a lie.
Senecor's program was actually 2 years long.
Well, then I found out he was not allowed to talk to us. We were not allowed to have any contact with him.
Not until Tim had been there at least 3 months. No phone calls, no visits. And there was one more issue, a big one. Penny says a Senecor staff member had told her that on-the-job training was part of the program.
I feel pretty thorough. I mean, like, I wanted to know what the program was, what they did. I wanted to make sure he was getting counseling and, you know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
I was very concerned about this work thing. And she was like, oh, no, they only work 20, 30 hours a week. They work them 7 days a week. 7 days a week.
Without any pay. Sho has gone deep into the whole world of rehabs that function more like temp agencies than treatment centers. Years before the pandemic, she found rehabs that sent people to work at assisted living facilities and at chicken plants that supplied KFC and Popeyes. After Sho and our former colleague Amy Julia Harris first broke these stories in 2017, they were finalists for the Pulitzer Prize. And at the dawn of the pandemic, when states were locking down, Senecor was still sending people to work, where they faced exposure to the coronavirus, and they often didn't get gloves or masks. At night, they came home to sleep in dorms with other participants. And again, the people getting this so-called treatment, they don't get paid. The deeper Sho dug, the more people like Penny would turn to her, looking for answers.
I've gotten dozens and dozens of calls like these from desperate family members and people stuck inside these rehabs. So when I hung up with Penny, I called Tim.
Well, from what I read, you know, it's a tough program. It's not like your traditional 12-step rehab or whatever. So I thought, well, I'll try it. It's something different. It was definitely different.
Tim says he was expecting a top-notch facility. He saw the pool on Senecor's website and packed 5 pairs of swim trunks. But when he got to Baton Rouge, the facility was one wing in a mostly abandoned former hospital. The pool water was a green, swampy color, and there was almost no time for counseling. After orientation, Senecor sent Tim straight to work. They had him doing electrical work.
I'm not even an electrician.
Did you get any training on how to do that?
No.
They had him making thick steel cables for shipping yards.
I was making those cables. I would sling them over my shoulder, and this big spool that is as big as a car, I had to pull it out 200 feet. I would be so sore the next day.
They sent Tim to a call center where he sat in a cubicle alongside paid workers. On his first day there, he heard a thump in the bathroom. He tried to get his supervisor to check it out, but in the end, Tim says he was the one who pushed the door open and found a worker there, unconscious with a syringe. The guy had overdosed.
You know, I'm still in a treatment facility, and then they put me to work at a job where people are on drugs. I was told that you would help me find a job. I wasn't told that I'd be just thrown into a van and hauled off to some job and be told that I like it or not. I have to do it.
Wow, Tim.
All they do is just work the dog out of you, and you don't get paid.
Senecor was keeping all of Tim's wages. And then there was the treatment Tim got. It seemed to work for some of the people at Senecor, but to Tim, it was like nothing he'd ever seen.
It wasn't very straightforward at all, like a 12-step based program or a faith-based program with, you know, religion.
The treatment was based on strange methods, squeezed into the few waking hours he had left after work.
They shaved my head when I was in there.
If he said the wrong thing.
Is that non-support? Go have a seat in the verbal chair for non-support.
If he broke one of the many, many rules.
The verbal chair. That's where I would sit with my hands on my knees, and I'd have to stare straight ahead.
The staff and other participants would yell at him or make him talk to himself in the mirror.
That was called mirror therapy.
Tim was learning a new Senecor language. He had to stare at his reflection and repeat what he did wrong and how he'd fix it.
I, Tim R., have a consistent behavior of talking in
my mind. I, Tim Rowe, have a consistent behavior of being late to the floor.
My positive solution is to stop talking in midline.
My positive solution is to set my alarm
clock. I, Tim Rowe, have a consistent behavior. And you just have to keep saying it over and over and over and over.
For how long?
However long they decide. And anytime you ever questioned it, I would be told that it's part of the treatment.
After just a few weeks of this, Tim felt broken. He wondered what could possibly fix him. The answer from everyone, the staff, the other people in the program, was always Senecor.
There were some times where I thought I was going crazy.
Yeah.
It was confusing. I wasn't sure of myself. I didn't know how to act. I was scared to think because everything I did was wrong.
When Tim's sister Penny finally reached him, she says it seemed like Senecor was brainwashing him.
So the two times that he did call here, he was only allowed to talk to us on speakerphone. Okay? And somebody was with him. So he was like, oh, yeah, it's great. You know, it's really great. The food's great. You know, he kept saying the food's great. And I'm like, why does he keep saying that?
Tim just didn't sound like himself.
And then he's like, yeah, just check it out on Senecor. Go check it out online. Well, he was trying to tell us something was going on without them knowing. You know what I mean?
Penny did check it out online. She read my reporting. By this time, I'd co-reported a story investigating Senecor, showing how dozens of people getting treatment there had been horribly injured at work. Broken backs, mangled hands. Somebody had even died at a Senecor job site in the 90s. I'd written about the millions of dollars Senecor was making off this program by sending people to work at job sites for companies like Exxon and Shell. After my stories came out, Shell emailed me that they didn't find evidence that Senecor participants had worked there, and Exxon denied it. But we confirmed that subcontractors for those companies did use Senecor workers. I tried to interview Senecor's CEO back then. He wouldn't talk to us on tape. When Penny learned how Senecor was sending its participants to work, she knew she had to get Tim out. After that sleepless night spent throwing up, she started calling Senecor at 8 a.m.
Couldn't get through. Couldn't get anybody to answer a phone till about 11:30. And I had to call the main Senecor place and go literally crazy to get them to get me transferred to Baton Rouge and make somebody answer that phone.
Penny also called the police and asked them to go check on Tim. An officer went to Senecor and told Tim his sister could fly him home that day. But Tim was surrounded by Senecor people, and he told the officer he was fine. He was too afraid to leave. He ended up sneaking out when no one was looking. He walked out into Baton Rouge, a place he'd never been, with no money and no ID. One of the first open businesses he found was a Comfort Inn. He convinced the woman at the front desk to let him call Penny. She got him on a flight to his mom's house in Florida. When I talked to Tim, he'd been out just a couple days.
How does it feel to be out of there?
It feels good. It feels good. I'm just sitting here. I'm like looking up at the sky and just kind of walking and talking. I haven't been able to talk about any of this.
Yeah.
You know, because you don't do that at CentiCor. You don't get that kind of therapy. You get work therapy. Whatever the hell that is.
Work therapy, whatever the hell that is. That's my first question. I have more. Penny does too.
Yeah, no, I'm really serious. I really want you guys to... I mean, there has to be laws being broke here. People working like that, I mean, that's slave labor. I mean, we outlawed slavery. I can't wrap my head around it. I can't be the only person.
No, you're definitely not the only person.
Over the next 3 weeks, we're going to answer that question and many others to find out how many programs like CentiCor are there out there, how many people end up in these programs, and where did the idea of work-based rehab even come from? We're going to tackle that question next.
We can take credit for literally getting thousands and thousands and thousands of people off of crippling addiction, fatal addiction. We have done that. We've done it here.
We're going back to the 50s and a violent cult called Synanon.
I didn't know it was going to turn into what they did, man, going out beating up on people, man, and guns and rattlesnakes in mailboxes.
That's next on Reveal.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. For years, Reveal's Shoshana Walter has been investigating drug rehabs that send people to work for free and keep all their pay. And the deeper she dug, the more questions that came up.
One of my biggest questions... where does this work-based rehab come from? And as I've learned from talking to hundreds and hundreds of people who've gone through these types of programs, I kept hearing it wasn't just about work. It also relies on a host of strange rules, punishments, and quote-unquote therapies.
There's 17 different types of punishments you can get. I've had all 17 of them. I've been to all three CentiCors.
Some of the punishments seemed like they were designed to be humiliating.
The first thing they did was they shave my head. They strip you down, kind of like take away everything that you think defines you.
There are all these ways that basically break people down into submission.
And they're like, who do you think you are coming here and trying to tempt us? Like, in my face, guys yelling at me like this.
Yelling in people's faces, mirror therapy. These are techniques used by CentiCor.
They are trying to brainwash you. You're not an individual. You're just part of CentiCor.
CentiCor uses these techniques, and so do a lot of other programs. We wanted to understand where this kind of therapy came from. So we followed the breadcrumbs, we traced it back decades, until we landed on a beach in Santa Monica, California, right outside LA.
This story is so big, we've had a team of reporters investigating it. Today, our colleague Ike Sriskandaraja follows those breadcrumbs back more than 50 years.
Let me take you back to 1958, when a revolutionary, first-of-its-kind rehab was born. It was called Synanon.
An instant guide to Synanon.
And it's not just CentiCor that modeled itself after this place. In fact, much of the rehab industry in the United States can trace its origins back to this one program that started right here.
Who started Synanon?
Synanon Foundation was started in 1958 by ex-alcoholic Charles E. Diedrich.
To understand the world of rehab options that exist in America today, why they are the way that they are, we have to go back in time to this place, Synanon, a place that made really slick explainer videos.
What is Synanon's cure rate?
Synanon has no way of keeping track of what people do after they leave. For the people who stay in Synanon, the cure rate is 100%.
I wanted to find people who were there at the birth of Synanon, or as close to the beginning as possible. And I was surprised to find anyone who is addicted to heroin in the 1950s who is still alive today. So I'm very happy I get to introduce you to
Candy with a K, K-A-N-D-Y, not no C.
By the way, Candy swears a lot.
Last name Latson, L-A-T-S-O-N.
Candy Latson.
I entered Synanon 7/14/1960.
Candy was 83 when we spoke, living in Santa Monica, in an apartment that's not far from where Synanon was founded. Synanon helped Candy get off drugs. The Korean War is how he got on them.
And that's how I started using drugs. I'd never had a drug in my life before. That's how I started.
When he was discharged, Candy came home from Korea, bounced around for a little while. By 1956, he landed in L.A.
And that's where I started shooting dope, shooting heroin. Was in L.A.
The second person I want you to meet is John Stallone.
One time I was in Florida when I was 15. Me and my friend Nikki, we would go down there and be gigolos, man.
I meet him in his garden apartment in Petaluma, California. He's 79 years old, big guy with long hair. He's hunched but strong. He kind of has a Flower Power meets Hell's Angels vibe.
When you were 15, you were...
Yeah, we went to Miami to be gigolos, man. We had a big shoebox full of pot. And we were going to go down there because all the...
Maybe I don't know what a gigolo is. I thought that was a male prostitute.
It is.
Yeah.
We talked like this for about an hour before I got in a single question about Synanon.
If you can introduce yourself and say the years you spent at Synanon.
I spent about seven and a half years in Synanon.
Just like Candy, he also started using as a kid in the 50s in his hometown, Brooklyn, New York. John got kicked out of high school for throwing a pie in his principal's face. It sounds kind of funny, but he still feels bad about it. And eventually, a neighborhood guy introduced him to heroin.
It was this warm, caressing feeling. And I said, I was off to races. I fell in love, man.
It was just something to do.
Before you know it, we were shooting junk every day.
How long does that last?
Until I went to Synanon.
Right now, in the U.S., we're in the middle of an opioid epidemic. The last one started after World War II. Increased international trade also brought more heroin into big port cities like New York and L.A., setting off alarms.
This is an alarm sounding in a police station somewhere in the United States. The alarm is meant for you. It's a warning to wake up, to shake loose from the grip of the nation's nightmare.
Roughly 3 million U.S. citizens are now in recovery or are currently addicted to opioids. But back then, the nation's nightmare was much, much smaller.
How many drug addicts are there? Well, no one really knows.
In the 1950s, the government estimated 50,000 Americans were addicted to heroin. There was no such thing as a narcotics rehab. If you were addicted to drugs, your options were jail, hospital psych wards, and 2 federal prisons. If you were west of the Mississippi, you went to Fort Worth, Texas. And if you were east, you went to Lexington, Kentucky, to a place called the Narcotic Farm. And that's where John went.
When I got to Lexington, one of the programs that they had was they would get guys, and they'd give them as much heroin as they want, and they would lock them in a room and observe them. Oh, interesting. He's vomiting. Yeah, diarrhea. was such an atrocity of using human beings as experimental animals.
Word didn't get out until the mid-1970s. But when it did, people were outraged. Congress launched an investigation.
Now, after you completed the testing program, did they give you any drugs?
You had a choice of earning days on the time that you were doing there, or you could get paid off in narcotics. I choose narcotics.
What did most of the other patients choose, narcotics or time off?
The majority of them choose narcotics. You were dealing with drug addicts. I mean, that's what they wanted, mostly.
So the so-called hospital that was supposed to get people off drugs was paying people in drugs.
And you're one of the last people from that...
That's alive today.
I spoke to historians who told me that some good research did come out of the Lexington narcotic farm. Prisoners were treated more like collaborators, and it was much safer for them than using out in the streets. But as a rehab, it was pretty much a failure. According to one study, 90% of people who left Lexington started using again within 6 months. For John, it was much sooner. As soon as he's back in New York, he's using.
I'm not going to shoot dope. I'm not going to shoot dope. I'm not going to shoot dope. You know, willpower is willpower. You know, eventually something would happen and I'd start using it again.
Willpower was basically the treatment for drug addiction at this point. But on the other side of the country, in Santa Monica, California, Candy Latson was about to encounter a revolutionary new treatment. Candy had been on a bender, shooting dope for 18 straight months. He'd lost his job as a janitor, ran out of money, and that's when he heard from a fellow user about this program on the beach. And on a summer day in 1960, deep in the pangs of withdrawal, Candy walked up the front steps of Synanon.
I just wanted to get well, to stop hurting, to stop throwing up, man. I'm still vomiting and I'm walking. And I opened that door and went in there.
It was a three-story red brick building that used to be a U.S. armory. The front looked out over Highway 1, and the back opened onto the Pacific. This was home base for a small gang of people fighting their addictions.
Synanon wanted you to come sick. They didn't want you to come well, because you would split, you wouldn't stay. But if your ass came sick, you got a couch, they put you on the couch, give you a blanket, a roll of toilet tissue, and a bucket, and you kick cold turkey.
This is the place that inspired a generation of rehabs and created a model that continues to exist today. The guy who dreamed it all up was a larger-than-life figure who'd never actually been addicted to narcotics. We heard about him in those Synanon promotional videos earlier. His name is Charles E. Diedrich.
I want to tell you a little story.
When I first met Chuck Diedrich, I hated Chuck Diedrich.
I was an extremely popular and charming drunk. I would come to your home and puke on your floor, and you would love me. Of course, I didn't love you.
What he looked like, he weighed about 280 pounds. He had a big belly, and he came to California to die.
It seems only yesterday, when the only thing that existed in life for me was the possibility and the reality of escape from life.
Chuck Diedrich chronically abused alcohol. His life was in shambles. He'd lost his job, his wife. He was living off a $33 a month unemployment check in a gritty apartment in Santa Monica. And he was down to just a suitcase of belongings, including a copy of Emerson's essay on self-reliance. Around that time, he started going to Alcoholics Anonymous.
And there was a meeting going on. And I suddenly realized that people were making speeches up there, that there were people listening to them. So I leaped to my feet and kind of rushed up to the podium and broke into some kind of a religious diatribe. I had the vaguest idea of the content, but it got a terrific hand. And everybody laughed. And so I said, this is for me.
So one night, after a meeting, he invites some of the folks from AA back to his place to keep the conversation going. But this time, without any of those pesky AA rules about waiting your turn or biting your tongue, and nothing was off limits.
Chuck could give seminars on Lao Tzu, Confucius, Jesus, Muhammad, you name it.
They'd debate politics, religion, sex, late into the night. It was heated, loud, and they'd fill every ashtray in Chuck's tiny apartment. There were only two rules: no violence, and nobody can be under the influence. Chuck's place keeps filling up, and eventually they need more room, so they get a little money together and rent a storefront.
And, of course, you know the story of Whitey Walker, who was an addict.
The story goes, a spring day in 1958, Chuck's gang from his AA club was having a lively discussion, and a guy named Whitey Walker came in. He was Sinanon's first drug user. He liked the conversation enough that he stayed, and for a while anyway, stayed off drugs.
That was unheard of. So when he got clean, the word spread to the street, hey man, there's a place down at the beach where addicts is getting clean. And that's when the addicts start coming in.
Quite a gang began to gather, and the addicts all began to kind of hear about it and began to come down to the beach, and we would somehow scramble around.
Scramble around and find places for people to stay. This ragtag group was becoming a residential program. Chuck knew he was onto something, so he got a lawyer friend from AA to help him incorporate. He wanted to call it the Tender Loving Care Club, but the name was taken. Then the group slurred their way into a word that meant nothing, but was somehow a better fit.
The word came from some guy who was announcing at 12 o'clock for the seminar. And instead of saying that, he said, Sinanon. And Chuck heard it. So he grabbed that word. And it had no meaning.
So on September 18th, 1958, Sinanon Foundation Incorporated was born. But its spiritual birth, that came a little after.
The real beginning of Sinanon. The real beginning of Sinanon.
So what happens is somebody gets loaded and they're trying to throw him out. And he's saying, you, I'm not leaving, man.
It was an explosion of a group of people.
So somebody turned around and said, hey, you know what? Why don't you shut the up? Because you were getting loaded with me a week ago. And now the guy shuts up and he looks at him. And then somebody else says, well, you know what? I was using too. I smoked some weed the other day. Another somebody else says, you know what? I drank the other day.
And everybody began to confess their sins. They began to cop, and it gathered tremendous momentum. Before we went to bed, a lot of people came to me and said, you know, there's something's changed. I'm going to go for this. I'm going to stay clean. I'm going to stay clean.
They called this the Night of the Great Cop-Out, and it became as central to Sinanon's origin story as Independence Day.
So Sinanon was born that night.
This is the moment that reaches into the future and is the reason we're telling you this story. So many of the rehabs that will follow were inspired by the events of this night and this idea of confrontation, candor, and people with drug addictions holding each other accountable.
In just a few short years, Sinanon will go from an ad hoc group on the beach to a national nonprofit with outposts around the country. Its growth is propelled by a powerful idea that people addicted to heroin can stop using. Ike will be back with the rest of that story. You're listening to Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Through the early 60s, Sinanon grows from basically a dorm full of people in California with a common goal to a treatment program with an urgent purpose.
Synanon's first order of business is to re-educate drug addicts, alcoholics, delinquents, and other people who find themselves unable to function responsibly in the larger society.
More people start hearing about the program and Synanon expands. They pull together donations and set up shop in the San Francisco Bay Area and even open a place in Connecticut.
Where do your residents come from? From all over the United States.
It was becoming a national program. And with the Eastern Outposts, Synanon could reach one of America's largest concentrations of heroin users, which in the early 60s was in New York. That's how John Stallone in Brooklyn first found out about it. Reveals Ike Sriskandaraja picks it up from here.
After John gets back from the narcotic farm, that part prison, part hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, he's using again. That place that was supposed to treat addiction only kept John from using heroin for about as long as the train ride home. Then he scored again. Eventually, John and his friend, who he gets high with, need more money to keep up their habit. So they bought an old gun.
So we bought a P-38. We had enough money to buy a P-38. I think it was about $5 or $10. And had old Nazi insignias all over it, you know.
They get their hands on this pistol that's probably haunted. And once they have it, they start robbing drugstores.
You know, we just want the opioids. Morphine, Dilaudid, Panapalm.
Back then, the government estimated that nearly half of all narcotics users in the United States lived in New York City. And robberies like this were on the rise. It all came to a head one day when John says another stick-up gang in another part of New York did a robbery that went really wrong.
Apparently, some idiots, man, stuck up a drugstore in Queens, and they killed the pharmacist, man. They shot him with a shotgun.
After that, John says the NYPD started cracking down. And that's when John ran into a guy from his old neighborhood.
He was gone for like over a year. We thought he was in a penitentiary. He said, nah, man. He said, I was out in this program. He says, this place out in L.A., he says, on a beach. He says, they got a program for dope fiends on the beach, he said. I said, well, what do you got to do to get in this place, you know? He says, nothing, man. You just got to tell him you're a dope fiend.
John's friend wasn't totally messing with him. If you followed Synanon's rules, you could go stay in a place that would help you get sober, which is really an incredible thing, even now. No insurance, no fees, and walk-ins were always welcome, which is what brought John into a Synanon intake center in Connecticut in 1965. He got accepted and was sent to Synanon in San Francisco. Free airfare, too.
What are Synanon's rules?
No psychic modifiers, that's no drugs or alcohol, and no physical violence or the threat of physical violence.
But when John gets there, he's high. And this violates one of Synanon's cardinal rules. When John finally cops to it, they boot him from the program. Eventually, though, they allow John to crawl his way back in with a few bizarre punishments.
You shave your head. I said, shave it? He said, shave it. It's okay. I said, we're going to dress you in some funny clothes and put a funny sign on you, and you're going to work your ass off. If they accept you back in the house. I said, okay.
They shave his head, put him in a dress and galoshes, and hang a sign around his neck.
What did the sign, what kind of clothes did they make?
He said, please help me. I try to kill my family.
These punishments, the head shaving, the strange costumes, the demeaning signs, they were making it up as they went along. They didn't know it, but the residents at Synanon were writing the rule book for an entire corner of what would become a multi-billion-dollar rehab industry.
I'm just going to tell you how poor we were.
In 1965, Synanon was still very much a scrappy, cash-strapped nonprofit.
50-man dorm. 50 men lived in one dorm.
And how do you feed a dorm full of people?
The guys would go out hustling in the morning. We call them hustlers. They would go to different places, grocery stores, you know, outdated milk, outdated cottage cheese, and you could write them off full price because we're a nonprofit.
Their tax-free status would become really important to Synanon's growth. But for now, it was just a way to collect some nearly rotting dairy.
My job was dairy sniffer. So I would take a container of milk, open it up, sniff it. If it smelled good, I put it in a milk crate over here. If it smelled sour, I threw it in the trash can.
Back then, the jazz scene was somewhat notorious for heroin use. And when some of them were trying to kick, they'd end up at one of Synanon's houses, or would at least pass through.
Miles Davis would send his group down whenever they came to town.
Whenever Miles Davis came to San Francisco, he would send his band to...
Yeah, but he didn't come because he was using it. He had respect. But he would send the rest of the band to come down and play for us in the afternoon.
So it was only natural that this rehab grew a jazz band of its own.
Okay. This is a record I just bought on eBay. The Sounds of Synanon. Side 1, CED. Charles E. Dietrich. And Joe Pass played on The Sounds of Synanon.
Joe Pass, the third greatest guitar that ever lived. I played on The Sound of Synanon with him.
Oh, is that right? What did you play?
I played the conga drum. Look on the label. You'll see my name, Candy Latson.
How about that? Okay.
Yeah, brother.
The record helped grow Synanon's profile and even made them a little money.
And we didn't get paid for it. The money went to Synanon.
Were you okay with that?
Yeah. Hell yeah. Okay. I was eating, sleeping, getting clothes from Synanon. Hell yeah, I was okay with it. We were a family, man. Synanon was a family.
Synanon was unlike a lot of families at the time. For one, it was diverse. When Candy joined, black and white people living together would have been illegal in many parts of the country. And the proud dad of this unlikely family, Chuck Dietrich.
That's the way Synanon was in the first 5 years of its existence. And of course, we hurtled into the public consciousness.
Life magazine called Synanon a tunnel back to the human race. A Connecticut senator on the floor of Congress said to President Kennedy, "There is indeed a miracle on the beach of Santa Monica, a man-made miracle that I feel can benefit thousands of drug addicts." And at the center of this miracle is an unorthodox therapy called the game.
Game, G-A-M-E. In the Synanon game, anybody can say anything he wants to say to produce any kind of an effect he wants to be.
The game is still around today. In fact, it's been central to so many drug rehabs, including Senecor, where participants tell us they still play the game at least once a week. I wanted to hear what this revolutionary therapy sounded like at its inception. The earliest recording I could find of the game is from an out-of-print documentary from 1961 called David. It's black and white and 60s cool with a tune by Miles Davis.
This is a story of a struggle by the sea. 60 people fighting for their lives by fighting to stay together.
I showed it to Candy because he was there around that same time.
I never saw this film, huh? I don't know how you got a hold of that, man. That's way back in the... Goddamn, that's almost the beginning.
The largest group of clean dope addicts freely gathered anywhere in the world.
In the film, around a dozen people sit in a circle. And the women are in dresses, and the men are all wearing button-downs and slacks. And one of the people in that group is a young black man who's lean and tall and spells his name with a K.
Candy.
Is that me? Yeah, that's me. Good Lord, how'd you do this, man? You boy, man, how did you do this? That's incredible. I mean, you got the early group. A group by the sea, they sitting outside on the beach.
This will be a Synanon session. A strange and violent group argument.
Oh, that's bull. He thinks it's a violent argument. These are tools for this group, man.
No psychologist has been able to explain a Synanon. But many believe it is the reason why more addicts have stayed off dope longer here than anywhere else in the world.
The game starts with Joe Pass complaining about David. He's a trumpet player and has been skipping rehearsals. They go back and forth about who whines more.
A complainer and a whiner and a baby. You whine more in one day about my whining than I whine in a month.
And then Candy starts going after David.
You've been implying that your wife come down as often as she does?
She's been here three times now.
Oh, I see. But do you think she's coming down too often?
No.
This goes on for another couple minutes. David saying he loves his wife and son and gets strength from being around them. And the others in the group, they all pile on him, asking, how long have you known your wife? How well do you know your wife? Isn't your marriage based on a lie? Candy leads the charge.
And you mean to tell me that you're willing to take this woman back and know that if she married a dope fiend, she got to be a big enough as a dope fiend?
So I asked Candy, how does stopping David from seeing his family help him stay off heroin?
Because he's going back to the same thing that produced him. He ain't ready yet. It don't mean he can't never go back, but you ain't ready to go back now. You ain't been gone long enough.
In this early session, we start to see what would later become a much more serious criticism about Synanon and its methods. Were people in vulnerable emotional states being coerced to do things against their will? In other words, was Synanon brainwashing people?
Well, we used to tell people, yeah, we brainwash them because their brain is dirty. And it is. It's full of heroin and morphine and wine and whiskey and cigarettes and lying and cheating and stealing. Yeah, we brainwash them.
That has a positive connotation to you?
Yeah.
Lots of studies have looked at these methods and the use of confrontational therapy to treat addiction. And the findings are pretty consistent. One paper summed it up this way. 4 decades of research show, quote, there is not and never has been a scientific evidence base for the use of confrontational therapies. In fact, researchers say these tough love tactics cause more harm than good. But that doesn't mean we've moved on from them. The methods Synanon started are still alive today. They're used by other rehabs inspired by Synanon. Rehabs like Senecor.
Synanon had created something that offered hope to people who didn't have a lot of it. It gained a reputation for that, for helping people get off and stay off drugs. But it was also going to change.
They were planning on doing vasectomies that following weekend.
I didn't know it was going to turn into what they did, man, going out and beating up on people, man, and rattlesnakes in mailboxes.
Okay. Now, I'm going to tell you how Synanon ended.
That's next week as we continue our look back at American Rehab. If you missed this series the first time around, you can listen to the whole thing on our podcast. Just search for American Rehab and be sure to subscribe to Reveal while you're there.
The American Rehab reporting team is Shoshana Walter, Laura Starcheski, and Ike Sriskandaraja. Brett Myers is our editor. Ike reported and produced our Synanon backstory. Laura is our lead producer. Amy Julia Harris helped us report this story from the beginning and launch this project. We had additional editorial support from Narda Zucchino, Andy Donahue, and Esther Kaplan. Production support from WHYY in Philadelphia. Research help from Claire Clark and David Hertzberg. Recording help from Chris Harlan Dunaway, and excerpts from David, a 1961 film played with permission from Drew Associates, Bay Area Video Coalition, digitized old real recordings of Synanon, fact-checking by Rosemary Ho. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy the Great Mustafa. Original score and sound designed by the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. Our post-production team is the Justice League, and this week it includes Jess Alvarenga, Catherine Steyer Martinez, Stephen Rascon, and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our CEO is Kezar Kampwala. Sumi Agarwal is our editor-in-chief. And our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Hellman Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Edson. And remember, there is always more to the story.